Welcome to the podcast of Greenlight Bookstore. This is the quarantine season. While Greenlight isn't currently hosting in-person gatherings, we're still striving for ways to create connection around books. Thanks to the gracious efforts of authors and interviewers scattered across the country and the world, we've taken our events programming online, hosting live readings, conversations, and audience questions via Zoom. Our podcasts this season are a record of those intimate conversations between thinkers and creators speaking from separate rooms, and a window into the ways that ideas and stories connect us all. Once you've listened to the conversation, you can purchase the books mentioned in this podcast at Greenlight's two bookstore locations in Brooklyn or on our website at greenlightbookstore.com.
Well, thank you, everyone. Good evening, and welcome to tonight's live online author event with Greenlight Bookstore. I'm Kay from Greenlight Bookstore, and we're thrilled to host tonight's event with Grace Lavery, launching her new book, Please Miss, A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Penis. She'll be talking with Elif Batuman, so you're in for an excellent time. Before we start, I just want to say a huge thanks to Grace, Elif, and the team at Seal Press for making this happen, and to all of you for showing up. We're grateful for your support and for the chance to make space for conversation and connection. And importantly, tonight's featured book, Please Miss, is available for sale from Greenlight Bookstore. You can shop in person from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. at both our Fulton Street and Flatbush Ave stores, where you can purchase Grace's book and many others on site. You can also order online at greenlightbookstore.com for a quick pickup at the store or for shipping anywhere in the US, or look for signed copies when you visit the store. If you care about supporting the careers of authors and the ongoing existence of independent bookstores, buying tonight's featured book is a great way to show your support. Our interviewer tonight is Elif Batuman, whose new novel, Either Or, is forthcoming with Penguin Press in May 2022. Her first novel, The Idiot, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and was shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction. She is also the author of The Possessed, Adventures with Russian Books and the People Who Read Them, a finalist for a National Book Critics Circle Award in Criticism, and is the recipient of a Whiting Award, a Rana Jaffe Foundation Writers Award, and the Paris Review Terry Southern Prize for Humor. She has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 2010 and holds a PhD in comparative literature from Stanford University. She will be speaking with our featured author, Grace Lavery. Grace Lavery is an associate professor of English at University of California, Berkeley. A prominent public intellectual and activist, she has contributed to the Los Angeles Review of Books, Autostraddle, The New Inquiry, Them, The Guardian, Foreign Policy, and Slate. She's been sober since January 2016 and full-time as a trans person since March 2018. She lives in Brooklyn, New York. Grace's new book, Please Miss, is a memoir like nothing you've read before. Part literary theory, part musical theater parody, part feminist sci-fi reboot, Please Miss was hailed by Tori Peters of Detransition Baby as a can't look away performance of wit, language, irreverence, and delight, and by Carmen Maria Machado of In the Dream House as the queer memoir you've been waiting for, a dizzying mix of theory and pastiche, metafiction and memory, hilarious and sexy and terrifying in its brilliance. Grace, we would love it if you can start us off with a reading from the book, and then Grace will be talking with Elif and with all of you. So without further ado, please take it away, Grace and In.
Yay. Thank you.
Hi, thank you so much. You know, it's unbelievable to be here. Thank you so much to Elif for agreeing to do this. I'm speechless.
Super excited. I'm going to disappear though.
Okay, so I have two bits that I was going to read. But the problem with this book is that, you know, part of the conceit of it is that all the different bits are different from each other stylistically. So you're sort of experiencing stylistic shifts often, meaning that if I were to read you one bit, you would think that, you know, that bit might represent the whole, and there's no bit that is like other bits. So, you know, what I thought I might read to you Yeah, okay. Well, I'm going to just do one for now, and then if we want to, we can come back. And I'll tell you a little bit about this. A lot of the book is a true account of things that have happened to me, and some of it is very much not true. Some of it is lies. And some of it is stuff that almost happened or could have happened or happened slightly differently to the way that I record it here. So what I'm about to record to you is a fictionalized fantasia on the first piece of hate mail that I ever received. And, you know, I will read you the letter. But of course, I want you to know that I wrote it. You know, I'm sure that's obvious, but I don't want anyone to think. Anyway, the following day was Monday. And I received an anonymous note in the mail. It was postmarked New York, New York, and the handwritten address read, Professor Grace Lavery, the new professor, English Department, UC Berkeley, California, United States of America. On the back of the envelope was a doodle, the kind of doodle one leaves on the back of an envelope that happens to be in front of one when one is caught on the phone with a distressed relative. Poking out above the fold was a crude rendition of a sinister clown, black-eyed and gothy, dankly reminiscent of something that one might find on the package of a poultry potation. This wasn't the first time I'd received an odd letter at work. My first year on the faculty, I had received an envelope postmarked San Diego, which contained a very short essay offering a history of the Japanese Navy's conduct during the First World War, B, glossy magazine-style photographs of American military personnel stationed in Southeast Asia, with my faculty profile picture cut out and stuck onto the background, and C, the typescript of what appeared to have been an old racist ballad about Japan. I had taken it to the campus cops, I wouldn't do that now, and they said, Professor Lavery, I have some good news and some bad news. The good news is that everyone gets one of these. The bad news is that this jabroni does seem to have a few less spices than the average cut of salami. The cutout photographs are a new development. So anyway, I opened the envelope and inside was a note written in courier, unmarked and unsigned, that read as follows. So, I don't want to sound like a nutball here, but it's time for a real true confession. I'm frightened of a clown. I'm wary of his eccentric manner and his unusual appearance. His choices make me feel ill at ease, and the language he uses, well, I find it unnerving. No, this is not satire, friend. I really am just plain bloody chilled by a clown. And if it's all the same to you, I'd rather not see him when he comes to my town or invite him to my house for any purpose. I know this sounds crackers. What, a little insane clown man, America's sweetheart, you're probably saying? And it's true. Suddenly, it seems like the clowns are everywhere, doesn't it? Like the sakura blooms at festival, like tarragon in my Uncle Buster's imaginative twist on the mint julep. Flowers swell fat with clowns, and out they burst, young and masculine and juicy. One runs a digit over the pod and inside it, and finds the merry shards that provide so many American children with genteel delight. Yet I am afeard of his taste in music, which I find perverse. And perhaps I find it worse than that. I demur from his sexual habits, which he insists on broadcasting. I find his prose style off-putting. And though I am not among those who will hold him solely responsible on this point, nor will I submit myself to further questioning on the matter, I will confess that the little clown fellow of whom I speak, I find to be quite thoroughly overrated on that front and many more besides. I wonder at the judgment of those who have supported his career so far. To me, it is as though he has some kind of malevolent hold over his benefactors, though of course I don't wish my own distaste to slip into outlandish and paranoid stereotypes. This particular clown just isn't for me, that's all. I see his face before me as I write, and to be perfectly candid, I find it quite unpleasant to contemplate. I understand that others may find his red nose to indicate merriment, but to me it seems crass. Many would find this clown's smile, which stretches warmly between his ears, to be welcoming and playful, but frankly, I think it verges on the sinister. His playful tufts of hair, which sprout at irregular intervals across his face and neck, not to my taste at all, I'm afraid. For example, does he commit crimes, this little clown man? Personally, I wouldn't aver it. Although now I ponder the matter more carefully, I wonder whether perhaps he shoplifts from time to time or texts while he's driving. In most people, I would consider these small infractions to be charming, evidence of an appealing, rebellious streak. But in the little clown man, I find them pettifogging and dishonest. Why should he flout rules that the rest of us are obliged to follow, which we mostly do to the best of our abilities? I wonder even whether it isn't further evidence of that willful cast of mind that underlies many of the qualities I find least tolerable in him, his insistent being, his presence, his refusal to disappear or die out, as I would that he would. It has taken me a while to realize that I'm not made angry by him as I initially thought. I believed that I wished to exterminate him by my own hand, to show him what it feels like, and to say, ha, now you know what it feels like, when so that he would know what it feels like when someone says that to you. Not nice, in short. But no, it's not anger, not at root. At its base, I am afraid of what makes a little clown man tick, of his quiddity, his characteristic essence. I shudder when I contemplate his innards. I worry, frankly, that he may have guts much like mine, indistinguishable from mine even, perhaps, under that lovely round belly of his. What if his guts are identical to mine? The thought quite unravels me. I find myself disappearing into an echo, a hollow whisper in my own cheeks. I am chary of a little clown man. Should I see him, I will surely repeat several merciless social maneuvers. First, in all likelihood, I shall receive him coolly in the presence of others. Others will be left in no doubt concerning the nature of our relationship. Second, I shall make dismissive eyes upon him and tilt my hips just so, to ensure that he knows that to my mind he doesn't belong here. Third, I shall talk dismissively of his field of expertise without acknowledging that such is it. Fourth, when I leave his company, I shall conspicuously neglect to wish him farewell, but simply wander off carelessly, tossing my head perhaps, as if to say, look at me, I have just thwarted a clown. Look at me, America, but I have just thwarted a clown. All shall know it. The clown was a cipher. The clown never hurt anyone. I knew what I was doing and I did it anyway. The clown was a patsy. The clown was a metaphor for the setting aside of childish things. The clown was a figure for literality. The clown was me all along. The clown was unrepresentable joy. The clown was fellowship and youth. The clown was sawdust and sweat and smiles. The clown was liquidity and paint. I loved the clown. I covet the clown. Please, clown, come back and learn how to love me. Teach me how to love myself. Remind me of that which I have forgotten. Come back, clown. We are ready for you. I love you and always did. That's the end of the letter. I'll read the next paragraph. It's difficult, obviously, when one finds that one's antagonists are clearly suffering from some quite devastating mental disability. Of course, part of me wanted to mock the author of this letter, to parade it round the department, flashing it to colleagues as proof of both the kind of pressure I'm under as a public figure, and also of the sheer lunacy of the anti-trans bigots who pester me, clown for whatever reason is a common term of abuse among them. But of course, I couldn't be sure that having done so, my colleagues might not think either that I was inappropriately mocking someone afflicted, apparently, with a delusional psychosis, or, which was worse, that the scrambled prose of my correspondent might in some way reflect badly on me, as though it was my responsibility, which I sometimes fear that it is, to obtain for myself a high class of hater. So I kept it to myself, spending the rest of the day wondering about clowns, the clowns I have known and loved. For strangely, I have known and loved many, and those clowns whom I have ever disliked, fewer in number, but more vividly kept in mind, if anything. Why, Americans, do you think that there is something transgressive about finding clowns frightening in the first place? You're supposed to find them frightening. You're American. Finding clowns creepy is as intrinsic to Americanness as is finding Kermit the Frog charming and genuflecting before your suburban Svengali, Mr. Rogers. It's because you all hate pleasure and are uncomfortable with ambiguity. You think clowns don't know what you think about them? That's why they're laughing. They get it and you don't. And I'll stop there.
Yay. Oh, I muted myself so you couldn't hear it, but all the chortling.
I heard you say yay.
I said yay at the beginning, but then I came back. But okay. So first of all, thank you for that incredible reading, and I'm so excited to be here, and I'm already regretting the way we were kind of joking that books are expensive, because everyone has to buy this book, which is now 10% off, because it's not just one book. It's like you're getting 40 books for the price of one book, and reading it makes your brain feel bigger, and it is an experience not to be missed, and everyone has to go to that link now and buy. The book, and it's just gonna be awesome. So thank you for that reading. Now I actually that kind of changed what I wanted to ask you, which is I just noticed this time. Well, so the first thing I wanted to ask was that was really a great reading. This book is like I read it once, but I think I need to read it like 10 times. Okay, I'm gonna stop talking and ask the question soon. So I was just thinking as I was looking at it, wow, this isn't what I expect from a memoir. So then I looked up memoir in the dictionary, and then I found all this crazy stuff, which is like, it's also one of those books where like you, after you put it down, it's like a really good movie. Like everything that you see just feels like it was invented by that person and put there as a joke for you. Mm-hmm. So that's how I felt about the entry for memoir. Cause it said, which I'm sure you know, but I didn't know this, that, oh, they're like, oh, it's from the French memoir, which is, when it means memory, it's feminine, but when it's a book, it's masculine. And because, and they like, the theory is that it was like écrit pour mémoire. So you're having like the writing is masculine. So, you know, what kind of the bullshit is already in there. And then, you know, the your life and what you remember, but it meant a lot more things. It could be, it's based in the knowledge of the author, but it could be about other things. And then I was thinking in some sense the memoir is the memory, and there's something about this book that is so filled with like little trivia, and it really feels like all the stuff that like more than any book I can think of, it feels like a representation of the stuff that a person carries around in their head and like goes over all day. So I was just wondering how you thought of the term memoir, and do you think of your book in dialogue with other memoirs, and just memoir, please.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's a beautiful question. And, you know, as I talk a little bit about in the first chapter, and, you know, I imagine many people are familiar with it, but there'll be some people who won't be. The term memoir is controversial for a number of contemporary readers, but I think especially for contemporary transgender readers. You know, I think a few years ago, there was a concern that began to circulate around the possibility of, on the one hand, predatory online publishers who were paying kids straight out of college $50 to talk about their worst blowjob ever or whatever it was. And there was this kind of salacious and exploitative trade in memoirs that was causing a kind of moral panic among roughly people my age and demographic. And, you know, the trans version of that, or the kind of the spin among that in the trans community, is that so much of transition and trans being has to do with problems of legibility, that there is something about simply saying who you are and what you have experienced. Mm. That feels coerced under any circumstances. So, you know, Vivian Namaste and Jay Prosser in the 1990s made this case fairly strongly in the kind of first generation of trans studies. And, you know, it didn't do anything to stop the boom of trans memoirs over the last 20 years, and nor should it. But it has been a kind of consistent thing that people are worried about. And some of the writers, the trans writers, trans, activists, community leaders, you know, people that I look to for guidance are actually often fairly skeptical of memoir. And I kind of sympathize with that. And the writers that I'm kind of really in conversation with, in some ways, trans writers I'm really in conversation with, people like, you know, Morgan Page, Sybil Lamb, people like that. These are people who really have eschewed and complicated memoir. So I knew that if I wanted to go back into memoir, I needed a specific reason to do so. And, you know, I think I have a couple of reasons to do so. And one of them is that I simply don't think that it's quite possible to expunge autobiography from any kind of critical or literary exposure. And secondly, that the
and it's
the
dangerous
types of,
too.
And it's Sorry. Dangerous too. No. But I totally agree. I think that that's where one, you know, becomes this kind of anxious back covering kind of one has a paranoid relationship to one's own signification, one's own dissemination, that it was really important to me not to lean into. But the other thing for that was that, you know, if that's true, if one can't expunge the memoiristic tendency from any other genre, and certainly, I mean, like, you know, I write literary criticism for a living in my day job, and I use the first person quite a lot, and I talk about my own phenomenological encounters with texts and movies all the time. And, you know, but if that's true, then it's true in the other direction too, which is that one can, in fact, allow other genres into a process of composing a memoir. And so that was why I often, in the course of composing this book, tried to think about texts that people wouldn't generally think of as memoir, but which in some way struck me as really disclosive or really intimately in conversation with the author's account of herself or himself. So, you know, the book, as you've said, you know, right, what, you know, people will like it or they won't, but it's a book with a kind of fairly encyclopedic energy sometimes. It has this kind of rattling through citations, and there are, you know, there are a lot of parts that involve readings and references of a fairly dense kind. But one of the touchstones, I think the two touchstones of this book, I don't know if I've really said this before, but they're both authors who were both profoundly committed to memoir and also never wrote a memoir. And they were also authors who were not alive at the same time, but the later one was obsessed with the earlier one. And the earlier one is Charles Dickens, and the later one is Franz Kafka. And these are two authors that, you know, there's something about the way in which these two authors think about style, and perhaps especially think about wit as a verbal performance of like comic charisma or something, that is profoundly motivated by intimate and even sort of uncontrollable disclosures of the self. So, you know, D.A. Miller's written a lot about the autobiographical signature in, for instance, you know, David Copperfield is the obvious one, but I think it's all over the place. And my memoir contains, as you know, a sort of fairly lengthy and unexpected reading of The Old Curiosity Shop. I hope unexpected. I don't imagine there are too many people thinking that the final chapter is going to begin with a sort of 20-page account of the kind of narrative conceit of The Old Curiosity Shop. But and the Kafka stuff is everywhere. And in that clown letter that I was just reading, you know, I was really tuned in this time to thinking about the short stories in which Kafka writes in the first person clearly isn't talking about himself. So, for example, he has a story which, you know, is just one of the funniest and weirdest things that there is, and I think is among the kind of central texts for this book of mine, which is called in German Elf Söhne, or in English 11 Sons, and it's an 11 paragraph story. Each paragraph describes each one of this person's sons. First person narrator, I have 11 sons. My first son's like this. And each paragraph begins with what seems to be a kind of vaguely affirmative statement of the son. My first son, he's great. He's masculine. He's hearty. He's strong. The girls love him. He's kind of stupid. He doesn't really notice the effect he's having on people around him. He's never going to come to anything, but he's, you know, he's not the worst person you can imagine. I mean, it's like, you know, I don't enjoy talking with him, but that's the end of the first. And then just, my second son's totally different. My second son's witty and precise and wise. And, you know, since he was young, he had this incredible facility to sort of really intuit what other people were experiencing. And, you know, yeah, sure, like, he's kind of shy, I guess. You know, he kind of, like, he runs away sometimes. He doesn't like you know, you can't like speak technically or whatever, but you sense, and it's, so anyway, my point is, like, it's this guy just trying to convince himself constantly that he can defend each one of his sons and being unable to do it. And I think that's what I kind of think of as memoir, because of course what Casper's doing there is imagining the way in which his father might talk about him. Everything in Kafka is about his relationship with his father's relationship with him. And he's sort of rehearsing various different possibilities. So that's the last thing I'll say about memoir. I realize, like, you know, I've taken this question around the houses, is that if one thinks through and with psychoanalysis, which I always do and probably always will, you know, one of the things that's kind of amazing about language from the psychoanalytic perspective is that even the language that one puts out into the world, that one emits, one transmits in the analytic session or in the text or whatever, has been given to one from somewhere else. So in fact, it's possible to play with addressee and speaker in the most complicated ways, even when one is simply thinking about oneself, one's own experience. So that the experience of memoir has at least as much to, on the one hand, it has to do with like telling your experience, but even more than that, I think it has to do with interpreting the signs that one is given in the world. And again, you know, I'm a scholar of literature and culture, so I interpret things. And I think if the book is a memoir, it's less a memoir because it tells the story of what happened to me, and it's more a memoir if it's in the sense that it's a set of attempts to interpret things that are happening to me. And and so this is just sort of an example in this moment that I read. It's like I receive a letter, it's bizarre. Obviously I actually wrote it, but at the same time, there's this question in the text of like, how do I take responsibility for this text that I've been given and that I have to now encounter? Mm-hmm. Anyway, you know, so many different possible answers to that question. But then the other part, okay, last thing is that for so long, And I haven't answered this question yet. You know, I haven't solved this problem to my own satisfaction, but for so long, part of the struggle of finding a transition, finding a way to transition, has been about finding a style to write in. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem of transition was that there was a style I used to feel pretty comfortable in, and I used to love, and I still love it, and I've been teaching it this week, which is the style of like, gay cultural criticism, in that like D.A. Miller is, you know, I went to grad school because I wanted to be D.A. Miller. I've always wanted to write like D.A. Miller, who wants to write like Roland Barthes, who wants to write like Marcel Proust, who wants to write like 19th century, like his understanding of what 19th century Japanese would sound like in French. And that's the kind of, you know, and it's amazing. And the answer is like, you end up with something that's like Kazuo Shiguro, and we're both comparative literature PhDs. But, you know, that essayistic tradition of like brilliant, baroque, gay precision is both a tradition in which, and it's a tradition in which this question of like what is disclosive and what's withholding is really present. You know, if you read a text like D.A. Miller's book, Bringing Out Roland Barthes, it's very much concerned with this question of like, what am I giving away when I write? But at a certain point, I just realized like, I can't write in this style. This isn't my style. This isn't who I want to write like. And I think that memoir is, you know, let me put it this way. I think if D.A. Miller had written the exact same book, people wouldn't be calling it memoir. People would call it criticism. Or maybe they'd call it a kind of like auto theory or something, I don't know. But the memoir is, I think, a kind of feminized response to the kind of spectacularization of the closet in a tradition of 20th century gay male writing. And when I think about like, who are the queer women writing in this kind of like post-Barthesian tradition that, you know, it's so valuable to me. One of the figures that's just been so indispensable and continues to be is Terry Castle. And if you think about like The Professor, the essays in The Professor, and especially Terry Castle's essay on Susan Sontag, which remains my you know, favorite piece of writing of the 21st century to date, you know, that's a text as well that has to do with like, how do we think about the fact of a living body in relation to the phenomenal effects and divagations, to use Barbara Johnson's word by Stefan Mallarmé, you know, how do we deal with the fact of a body as a different kind of phenomenon to the phenomenon of like this textual dissemination? I'll definitely stop there.
Oh, thank you. That's so much. Yeah, I'd never thought about, I mean, listening to you talk about it, I couldn't see the relationship between pastiche and memoir. And now that seems so, it just seems like the mm-hmm. clearest possible thing that, of course, and also what you were saying about Dickens and Kafka, and because I was thinking like, so one of the questions that I wanted to ask you was, you kind of already answered, but so reading this book, I had the feeling that I'm reading something that was unlike all other books, but it was so funny. And I was thinking, is that it's often a characteristic of books that are not like other books, is that they're not funny. And I was wondering if that is related to humor, is drawing on some kind of community. And if you're, you know, consciously trying to go outside of that, it's very hard to sort of bring the apparatus of humor with you. But what you just said is the exact opposite. And it made me realize that like the reason it feels like a book and which everyone should buy, is that the thing that you feel cushioned by in the lack of any of the apparatuses that you're used to is the thing that you just said, the wit, the thing that you, from the Kafka and the Dickens, this humor that you feel cared for as a reader. Just there's like always a delightful joke put there to delight you. I guess.
The question I have was,
how do you do that? How do you create that? That feeling of unchartedness and that feeling of like, we all know what this joke in a very, I mean, I hadn't actually thought of Dickens, but it does, I mean, it does feel like a very kind of like inclusive Dickensian kind of move.
Yeah.
Which Dickens Kafka feels like.
Dickens really is the encyclopedian par excellence. You know, Dickens' mm-hmm. whole way of thinking about the world is to stuff as many different bits into a text as possible, and then to start thinking about the connections between them and allow the connections to develop in odd ways. And obviously, you know, there's a lot to be said. And if I was wearing a scholarly hat, there would be a set of questions about like various different moments where Dickens is exerting a strong form of control over the diversity of elements in his text, as we know, you know, like he did when he sat down to write Dombey and Son. That was the first one that he supposedly kind of really rigorously worked out. But you know, at the same time, even in those late Dickens texts, which are really so rigorously plotted, there are still misflights birds, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when we as readers encounter that list of misflights birds, something happens which is not rigorously controlled or controllable. And, you know, Andrew Miller, who's a Dickens scholar that I admire very much, has this really wonderful line where he says that the capacity of the Dickensian, it's a distinctively distinctive dimension of Dickensian style, is a capacity for self-surprise. That, you know, there are moments in Dickens, and I think Miss Flight's Birds is one of them, I think there are moments with Skimpole as well in the same novel that are like this, where you know, you catch him really surprising himself with what's happening, and there's a kind of unexpected delight. So But you know, the answer to this question in a kind of, again, literary historical term would be like, the reason why this is possible and the reason why the Dickensian charismatic voice is able to sustain this kind of difference is, you know, you do the police in different voices, or, you know, because it's a performance, because it is a virtuosic theatrical experience, is what the scholar David Koenig has written a great deal about, that Dickens, like many 19th century novelists, wanted to have been a playwright, and in fact, you know, made a great deal of money and spent a great deal of time touring around the country, reading his novels and doing the different voices of the different characters, and that's the sort of charismatic centripetal energy that he produces. And it's not true in Kafka, like the sort of opposite is true of Kafka. But the part that is similar, I think, or the part where I would want to draw a through line is through this, you know, I realize I'm sounding so much more like an English professor than I wanted to. I just want to say, you know, the book has a lot of dick jokes. So if you're reading this and thinking like, I just don't care about Dickens at all. Like there are dick jokes in every page.
It puts the dick in Dickens.
I mean, literally there is a list of like pornographic titles for all of the Dickens novels, Hard Slimes being the one I'm proudest of. But the thing that is similar is this genre of comic writing, or broadly comic writing, that Northrop Frye talks about in The Anatomy of Criticism, which he calls the Menippean satire. And, you know, I don't know enough about Menippus or Menippius to tell you how accurate the designation is, but what he specifically has in mind is a classical genre that exists through the 18th, 19th, 20th, 21st century. I mean, obviously he's writing in the 50s, so he's not talking about the 21st century, but it continues to exist. And I think this book is one in some ways, which is a sort of satire of the philosopher who claims to know everything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some of the examples would include Robert Burton's The Anatomy of Melancholy, which is a big, big fat book that is a sort of early modern treatise on melancholy that is also this kind of deeply melancholic and paranoid text in itself that refuses to articulate any straightforward claims. Northrop Frye also argues that the essay form in the Montaigne setting is kind of a Menippean satire in the traditional sense. In the modern setting, in the 18th century, we have Tristram Shandy by Laurence Sterne, which, as everyone knows, is this totally bizarre book that has more digression than text. And because it has more digression than text, then it raises the question of what a digression actually is. Another one that's important to me is Thomas Carlyle's Sartor Resartus. But I think, in any case, this way of like joking about the philosopher's claim to know everything becomes part of the Dickensian way of thinking about the world in general and the way of thinking about the comic in general. So, you know, it often seems like slightly Toryish and even slightly conservative in Dickens, which has this sort of, a kind of skepticism about world making that, you know, is clearly in his case motivated by the one thing that isn't funny in Dickens, which is his absolute loathing of Black people, his absolute like vicious inability to imagine a world in which there is Black freedom or Black pleasure. In Bleak House, in fact, the Mrs. Jellyby stuff is really, really intense. And it's a moment where this kind of satirical treatment of the liberal do-gooder actually becomes indistinguishable from kind of like, as it was for Carlyle, absolutely kind of intense racism. It's not merely this kind of like conservative or reactionary dimension, and I think it actually becomes this other way of holding something about world making, something about totalitarianism at bay. And that's what happens in Kafka, where, you know, when anyone reads Kafka for the first time, they're always like, oh my god, it's so depressing. And when you read Kafka for the second time, your response is always like, oh my god, it's so funny. And those things are kind of both true. And it's that flipping between those two things that I think comes from the Menippean dimension that Kafka's picking up from Dickens. And just to like, you know, say the thing, because I don't say it in the book, because Kafka doesn't even get mentioned by name in the book, but it's like, if you know Kafka, you will, I think, find a lot to recognize in the book. You know, we know from Kafka's diaries that he read Dickens consistently and was kind of worried that Dickens had already said everything that he wanted to say, which is bizarre because no one reads Kafka and thinks, you know, this is the kind of like capacious jollity of like,
this is the ground that Dickens present. Covered. Why did he bother? Exactly.
I mean, it's so weird. But of course, like, you know, on the one hand, it has something to do with the position of the law and the way that Dickens thinks about law, but it actually also has something to do with, I think, the way in which Dickens treat knowledge and the idea of the knowable and the ways in which we build the social through these kinds of like comic networks.
This really, I didn't notice this the first time, but your note on the copyright page. Oh, also, we already have one question, which is very related to what we've been talking about, and that's going to be fantastic. And people should be preparing their other questions. But I just have one question, how did you get to write how did you think of, what did they want you to write? Could you read does it exist in the English?
Yeah,
one
totally.
Too?
Yeah. So I have like this kind of slightly pretentious note on the copyright page, right, which is just like here, where I've written, in On Truth and Lies in an Extra Moral Sense, Nietzsche defines truth as a sum of human relations which have been poetically and rhetorically intensified, transferred, and embellished. Accordingly, readers should not expect any act of writing to depict the non-fictional world with anything like unmediated accuracy, and certainly not one authored by someone pretentious enough to remind them of the facts on the copyright page. What they mean is certain names and identifying details have been changed. So, you know, I have to say the idea for this was came from my wonderful, wonderful, wonderful editor at Seal, Claire Potter. And Claire just said, you know, we need to write something about the relationship between the text and, you know, we need to write something legally indemnifying for the book, because, you know, everyone has to do this. And, you know, as you can probably imagine, having read it, there were some fairly tricky legal questions that were raised around, like, you know, for example, imputing, describing a story in which, like, my uncle beat up my mother in front of me. And that's a story that I tell pretty directly. And, like, you know, we need to talk to lawyers about that. But there's also, like, you know, a set of really cruel jokes about Conrad Black and Robert Webb. And the lawyers were kind of nervous about that. And, like, the kind of different intellectual property stuff with the pastiches that were coming up. So, you know, it was like, just, we just need something simple. But Claire's idea was that I could write something that might actually say something worth saying about the connection between the book and the world that it was describing. And I don't know, I didn't want to write an essay, and I didn't want to write anything that was going to be so awfully pretentious as to totally scotch the, you know, ideally people want, I want people to buy the book. So, you know, a little reference to the famous Nietzsche essay. Nietzsche as well, I think, is a great thinker of the Menippean satire, especially the late Nietzsche. It's very much about, like, I'm not really interested in saying anything, but what I'm interested in is having fun with the impossibility of saying anything. And, you know, I think it's no surprise that Nietzsche actually himself was, like, weirdly interested in Thomas Carlyle, as was Gilles Deleuze, strangely enough. And Deleuze is, like, again, a figure of, like, maybe a kind of Menippean satirist. But so, you know, I think that's what I'm doing there, just trying to say, like, this is a book that really actually wants to play with the law. And I guess,
I love that.
You know, it's a book that wants to play with the law in a few different ways. One, with copyright, right? So, like, for example, you know, there's this one sequence towards the end, and I'm going to see if I can find it just so I can show you what it looks like on the page, where I am quoting a Buddy Holly lyric, and we simply could not get the permission for the Buddy Holly lyric. So my suggestion was that we black out every word except for a couple to make a little statement. So it now says, why you care, sigh. And then there's another moment, which is like over the way, there's like a pastiche of Hamilton. And, you know, it was like the pastiche of Hamilton. So, I mean, I can read it out. It's like, moved him with his cousin. But the thing is, what I'm going to say is I'm going to read this out now. But when I did the audiobook, I wasn't allowed to sing it, because although the words were parody, if I sang it to the tune, then it wouldn't count, and it would be in violation of the law. So, like, it goes, moved in with his cousin committed suicide, a suicidal cousin was a wound to the family pride, a friend of his cousin said, you gotta mind your health, Alex retreated to the oven, said, you mind it by yourself. And I can do it in this setting, because, you know, we're not, this isn't the same kind of thing. I hope I can. Maybe someone's gonna, like, maybe Lin-Manuel Miranda is about to batten down the door and tell me that, you know, I owe him money, but I'd be surprised. Anyway, my point being is that this is a book that wants to fuck with the law, and it wants to fuck with libel, and it wants to fuck with intellectual property, and it wants to fuck with, you know, various different questions in which, you know, a book situates, with which a book situates itself in relation to the law. And, you know, this actually gets me, it's a beautiful place to end, because it gets me right back to that question at the start about, like, what are the genres outside of this kind of like Baroque gay male critical tradition in which a trans woman can begin to write herself? And, you know, I mentioned Terry Castle, but the other big one, and the person who fucks with the law better than any other writer that I can think of, is Janet Malcolm, your erstwhile colleague. And, you know, when Janet Malcolm writes about the law, especially in relation to psychoanalysis, you know, she makes it feel so vital and so fun and so sexy. And, you know, the idea of going to law against someone, going to the law against someone, is kind of incredible, incredibly dynamic thing. So anyway, you know, as you know, Ellis, I've
suffered for that.
She did. I mean, absolutely she did. Yeah, no. And it, I mean, I really hope Conrad Black doesn't sue me, but it's something that I really admire about her work. And you know, it's kind of eros in its relation to the writing subject as a body, and the writing subject as a legal person, is something that she really helps me think about. But, you know, as you know, I've already written this novel, which is kind of a follow-up to Please Miss, but the next thing I'm going to write, the next kind of creative thing, the next creative project I'm engaged in, is a legal rom-com. And trying to write about lawyers falling in love. I mean, it's also a serial killer narrative, but, you know, but a legal rom-com, because, you know, yeah, exactly. I think, I mean, it's going to be like Ally McBeal meets like the Buffalo Bill plot in Silence of the Lambs, is the idea, I think.
It's good. It sells itself. Okay. Mm-hmm. So related to the thing that to what you were just saying is this first reader question from Katie Clapp. Could you speak to why you chose to include fiction in your book, and how, as the reader, we're supposed to accommodate the blend? As someone who values truth and honesty, I find myself not trusting anything if something in there could be false.
Yeah.
It's like, you want to fuck with the law, but you don't want to fuck with the reader.
Yeah, that's definitely right. I don't want you to not trust me. And I definitely think that the book is an attempt to earn your trust. It is an attempt to make myself worthy of that trust in a few different ways. One of them is to get really, really honest with myself and with you as a reader about the ways in which I necessarily fictionalize just by the act of making language. Right. The moment that we speak in a speech genre, the moment we're using a speech genre, we're abiding by certain kinds of rules. And therefore, you know, we can feel the contours of genre pulling against us. So what I'm really trying to do is use genre to sort of pull pretension away and strip down language to its most possible disclosive state. Which is why, again, you know, and this gets back to Ella's first question, you know, comedy is so important to me, because comedy is a place in which dishonesty is impossible, because it's a response that bypasses ratiocination. If something is funny, then the level on which it is true bypasses doubt, you know, and of course doubt will come back in, but that's what I hope is the case. And I'll tell you, like, you know, I think in general, and I hope Ellis will agree with me, there are very few moments in this book where you're not sure if something happened or not.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Like, you know, there are whole sections where this stuff is clearly a fantasy, but there's no moment that doesn't feel like a fantasy that was one. You know, there are moments that are... That are sort of lightly edited or whatever, but there are moments. So actually, you know, just before I came here, I was out with my friend, my collaborator, someone I've known and loved for a very long time. His name is Cecilia, who is, you know, an inspiration to me in a lot of different ways, and is also a kind of massive intellectual influence on me as well. And she and I were talking about the scene in the fourth chapter, in which she appears. The first half of the fourth chapter is a kind of attempt to relay a conversation that she and I had. the first time we met after I had transitioned. And, you know, she was saying today when we were just at Balthazar's, she was just saying she remembers like word for word these things being said. And, you know, I was contacted again by a friend in the UK last week who had, you know, his copy of the book had arrived on Friday and started reading it. She was like, oh my God, I remember when that happened. And again, it's like, there's a real attempt to be extremely precise about the details, if there's any attempt to persuade you that something really happens. But there's also some attempt to really get honest with and refuse, in fact, polemically to refuse the comfortable logics by which we acclimate ourselves to generic conventions of life writing.
I was just thinking about what a bold move it is for to do a fantasia on your own hate mail and do it. Doing that as a reading, there's something so an incredible rhetorical move and the kinds of, I mean, you make your hater quite smart. I don't know. It was just something that I was thinking of. There's reader questions too. That are more important than my ill-formed thoughts.
Binwan is asking me what's the word made. Yeah. Well, it's not made up by Barbara Johnson's reference. Yeah. It's not made up. It's taken from the Mallarmé. It's divagation, splitting like that. A lot of post-structuralist critics were super interested in various different vaginal images for spatial arrangement. And, you know, this was divagation, splitting of a single meaning into two, which is different to the Derridean motion of invagination, which is when two things curl back and make an enclosure like that. You know.
So we all learned a new word, new to some of us.
Well, so, but the important one, and the one that they didn't actually talk about is seclusion, which is a text that, a word that is like conspicuously not in this book, but seclusion is another text for thinking about the vaginal enclosure. But it's a way of referring to the grasping and pulling in of an object like this, right, with a pen, as an active move. So it's a sort of transitive act of clenching in which the object is the thing pulled in rather than penetration. So, you know, there's sort of like attempt in feminist sort of sexuality studies to think about penetration in such a way as to privilege the seclusive rather than the penetrating, and to think of the seclusive as the active rather than the penetrating as the active. And, you know, that's something that the book thinks about in various different ways. And it's, you know, the word penis is in the title. And as they say, there are dick jokes everywhere, but there is this kind of question of like, what does it mean to stop thinking about the penis as a kind of active or penetrating object? Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that. Oh, we got a thank you. Are there any more audience questions? Or should we? I mean, now I'm thinking about.
I can read a little more because the thing is, you know, if we've got time.
Yeah, we have. We don't have very much time. We have 3 minutes.
Well, so let me just read a paragraph, because the thing is, I just saw that there were a couple of people in the room who actually were in this moment. That so this would be a great opportunity for me, because I just saw that someone is in this room who was a grad student in a class that I was teaching when I was, you know, undergoing transition. And so I'm just going to read a part that describes, you know, that moment of coming into class and. Anyway,
Thomas Carlyle at Greenlight. It sounds like he was there signing books.
A penis is not a dick. A penis is definitively not a dick. A dick is the thing that a penis is not. Insofar as the given object is a penis, it is there to also be not the dick. The day I came out at work, I spent some time trying to work out whether the characteristic part of a barrow pig that hits the title character in the face of an early chapter of Jude the Obscure was a penis or a dick. And there's a quote from Judy Obscure. In his deep concentration on these transactions of the future, Jude's walk had slackened, and he was now standing quite still, looking at the ground as though the future was thrown thereon by a magic lantern. On a sudden, something smacked him sharply in the ear, and he became aware that a soft, cold substance had been flung at him and had fallen at his feet. A glance told him what it was, a piece of flesh, the characteristic part of a barrow pig, which the countrymen used for greasing their boots, as it was useless for any other purpose. Pigs were rather plentiful hereabouts, being bred and fastened in large numbers in certain parts of North Wessex. Characteristic part is an odd phrase, this is me again, since it implies a part that is more than a part, that is indistinguishable from other parts and therefore not exactly a part at all, or whose particular qualities determine the identity of the whole under some taxonomic scheme. Blah, 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 blah. I wasn't sure that the students were especially interested in this distinction, but the difference between a material body and the body as it is fantasized into existence, formalized and mythologized, was all that was on my mind. And I'll end there. And just because saying this and recounting this will hopefully at least prove to someone in the room who was in the room when that very thing happened, that I'm pretty serious about being honest about things that I fuck up.
Thank you so much. This is fabulous. There's another audience question. Do you want to read that, or it's kind
totally.
Of a long
do you
one,
want to read it?
It's as a it's written by a non-Black queer teacher who's thinking about moving through spaces as a trans teacher and how students demand legibility in their own way. As a non-Black trans teacher working with predominantly Black students, I wonder how you navigate different spaces and demands for legibility from those whose experiences of oppression are different, but are also experiencing problems of legibility. It's an interesting question.
It's a big and big, interesting question. Just to be clear about the syntax, because it may not have been obvious to people who are just hearing that rather than reading it, but Vin's friend was saying that they are a person who works primarily with Black students. I don't work primarily with Black students.
Right, I was a little confused.
No. I mean, that was all very clear in your reading and in the comment, but it was just, you know, I wanted to be clear about that myself. It's so hard. You know, I remember the week that I came out at work, literally the week after that, it was Prospectives Grad Student Recruitment Week at Berkeley. And I had someone come to me in my office and just ask me what it was like to be trans at Berkeley. And I was like, I've got no fucking idea. Like, I've been doing this for less than a week. Ask me in 5 years. And even then, I'll give you a very sort of partial answer.
I'll give you a Manipian satire.
Yeah, exactly. I'll give you a Manipian satire about how legibility is kind of like impossible and maybe, you know, and the other thing is, like, there's so much, especially in like trans of color studies, about the limitations of visibility and legibility as rubric to transition. And, you know, I'm very familiar with reading, important work in this subject by Tourmaline, by Che Gossett, by Eric Stanley, who's a colleague of mine at Berkeley. It's a topic that is easy to theorize, but in terms of the pedagogy of what does it mean to be out, and how does outness work for white trans people? It is a complicated question, because the thing is that a significant majority of queer and trans out students at Berkeley and community members of Berkeley are not white. And, you know, I'm not sure that I know exactly why that is, but I've been part of the, I currently chair the Chancellor's Advisory Committee on LGBT Community, so I know the statistics. And
there's a clarification from the question asker that's saying that they're not white, but they're not Black. So it's
I realize the question asker is not white. You're a non-Black queer studies scholar. I can best answer this as a white queer studies scholar, because that's what I bring into the room. It's not a question that I know how to answer. All I can say is that I find that queer and trans community is a place where it is possible to get honest and open about the racial logics of visibility. And that's rare in this world, because this is a world that tries to stop us from talking about the racial logics of visibility, that tells us that the only dignified response to racial hierarchies of existence is to pretend not to see them, which is, you know, a horrifying abnegation of social relations. So I find that, yeah, totally. So I find that it is useful and important to be able to avow and acknowledge differences, and at the same time to know that I am sometimes positioned, you know, as I say, I'm chairing this committee and the committee's largely white. My co-chair isn't white, thank God. But, you know, I'm sometimes positioned as a kind of visible figure. And I'm very aware that, in fact, my visibility is troubling in certain ways. You know, the argument that Morgan Page makes in her essay in Trapdoor, which is a great collection on, the paradox of visibility for trans people. The argument Morgan Page makes, which I admire and struggle with because it, you know, it's one of these things where if it's true, like I'm not doing the right thing. So I struggle with it. But Morgan Page says, you know, throughout the history of trans people, there have been trans celebrities who have been mostly white, mostly privileged, mostly kind of like not exactly cis passing, but mostly kind of passing and legibly trans feminine, the kind of like Caitlyn Jenner types of the world. And they get on the front cover of magazines and people give them a lot of money. And all they do is draw attention to the community. And what that does is it escalates the pressure of everyone who is trans that is not on the front cover of Vanity Fair. And so that visibility itself for, you know, the kind of stereotypically white, charismatic, trans feminine heroine is this, it's a way of actually increasing and escalating and intensifying oppression of especially trans people of color who do not have the same institutional protection. It's a very, very powerful argument. And I think about it all the time. And my visibility is not your visibility, and our visibility is not their visibility, and that, you know, these are important distinctions to avow and to acknowledge. And at the same time, I am aware that when I have been in conversation with community around some of these issues, it has been possible for, you know, for honesty and disclosure to be made possible. And I'm really moved by something that Ella said about feeling this was a book that was in some way moving outside of the implicit community of genre, which I think is true. And I also think that this is a book that is desperately in love with community and in need of queer and trans community. And queer and trans community is vital to me. It's how Elif and I know each other. You know, this is how this event is happening, because like we're queer writers in New York together or whatever. And it's essential to me. It's essential. It's not something I can dispense with.
Thank you both so much. I feel badly to say like time's up, because I feel like you just got started and I know those questions can only just continue to roll on in. Thank you, everyone. Please, please go support Grace in her debut, Please Miss, a heartbreaking work of staggering penis, available at Greenlight. You can buy it online, 10% off with the coupon code in the chat. You can also pick up a personalized copy, IRL. Thank you both so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you all so much. This is amazing. Thank you so much, Kay.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Greenlight Bookstore podcast. We're grateful to our production partners at Libro FM for working with us to produce the quarantine season. Libro FM provides access to thousands of digital audiobooks through partnerships with independent bookstores nationwide. You can purchase Libro FM audiobooks at greenlightbookstore.com. You can subscribe to the Greenlight Bookstore podcast on iTunes, download it as a free audiobook from Libro FM, or stream it on greenlightbookstore.com/podcast. On the Greenlight website, you can also find links to purchase the books discussed in this episode and many more, as well as information about Greenlight's store locations and shopping hours. The best way to support your local independent bookstore and the literary communities we serve is as simple as buying a book.